Hi, this is Andrea Vicari, and you're listening to Jazz Doodles on jazzlondonradio.com. Today's show's all about drummer Peter Erskine. Peter Erskine made his first break with the Stan Kenton Orchestra. He then went on to play with the very famous group Weather Report, and has been known to play with other groups such as Steps Ahead, and also collaborated with British musician John Taylor and Kenny Wheeler. I have an interview with him when he was visiting London in May, just a week before his couple of dates at Ronnie Scott's.
I'm sitting here with Peter Erskine, jazz drummer. Thank you for coming on the show. It's a great privilege. You're one of my heroes. Welcome to London.
Thank you.
According to your website, which is one of my sources of information, you've got 50 albums to date as a leader and a co-leader. Wow, that's really something. But you've also got a new album called On Call, with John Beasley, Bob and Benjamin Shepherd, on your own record label, Fuzzy Music. So I wondered if you wanted to tell us a bit about that new CD and the band and the music.
Okay, would love to. Even though Bob Shepherd and Benjamin Shepherd share similar sounding names, Bob Shepard is no relation to Benjamin Shepherd. Benjamin is a young and fabulous bass player from New Zealand, who has settled in Los Angeles. He plays both upright bass and electric in the Dr. Rum Band. His role or function is to play electric bass, and he really brings the funk. Bob Shepherd is a wonderful saxophonist who I've known since 1979 when I first moved to Los Angeles. John Beasley, who I guess we could consider like the MD, the music director for the Dr. Rum Band, is also known to many of your listeners as being the MD of International Jazz Day. The last few years, he's been the person responsible for putting those shows together.
He's also recorded, he's got a band or something that's called Monkestra, isn't it?
The Monkestra, yeah. In fact, yeah. I was depping for one of their drummers who normally plays with the band. We did some European festival dates, and we played Ronnie Scott's for two nights. That was about a year ago, and it was so much fun. Yeah, John's a great arranger, he's a great keyboard player, he's a great musical conceptualist. Without John, I don't know if the entire Dr. Thing ever really would have gained traction. We're up to our third album now, the one that you mentioned. It's titled On Call. Whenever the band plays in Europe, particularly in Germany, it's always announced as Dr. But the joke, which is apparent to most people, especially when you see it in print, it's Dr. U.M.
Drum.
Dr. So Dr. Is my alter ego. And it was a way for me to kind of return to the funk and R&B stuff, kind of like fulfilling that wish that older people have, if I'd known then what I know now. So I just gave myself a playing environment where I could play the funk, but play it with the advantage of just having played for so many years now. And I'm having more fun than ever.
So I'm was going to ask you a question about your appearance at Ronnie's, but I'm just going to sidetrack a little bit because we were talking about your return to funk and how it interests you. And if I had to describe your strumming styles, I would say you're a jazz drummer who's not only embraced the jazz tradition, but also someone who has taken on the stars of other music genres. And I'm going to say such as reggae, that I'm thinking about the Pools groove, and Latin, things like the Pushes.
Reggae. I have to be honest, when I look in the mirror, I don't see an expert in reggae drumming staring back at me.
Did you pick up, I mean, that thing of where you listen to music and you subconsciously adopt styles, when a lot of my drumming friends, I play a bit of drums but not professionally, get together, they all say, talk about your groove on Pools.
Oh.
You know, and we love it, but it's gosh. I mean, maybe it's just...
The groove on Pools is just thanks to the brilliance of the tune, the composition. Invited that, and the composer, Don Grolnick, didn't like the beat I was playing the first time around. He said, can you do something different? So I just took the beat I was playing and turned it upside down, that was all, and just kind of reversed it, and it seemed to work. The drumming that I do I think reflects that, you know, I was a child of the times. I started off listening to Art Blakey, and then the Beatles came along. But I was as compelled to listen to Elvin Jones at that point as I was to Ringo or Hal Blaine and the guys who were making all the pop and rock records and stuff. But, you know, jazz took notice of rock, and I feel really lucky that I, you know, got to buy a jazz album week after week in the mid to late 60s, because every record seemed like a postcard from the future. Hey, we're having fun here. Wish you were here. It just seemed like whatever rules that I might have imagined there'd been in the distant or not so distant past were just all being broken. So everything was this very positive message of yes, musically. I don't know how much of that's being provided to younger musicians today. I don't sense it. Everything has really changed. Luckily, we can at least look to the past in that same era, and the music was so good, it still provides a ton of inspiration and excitement. But there was nothing like it at the time, when it just seemed every corner you turned, there was all this new information musically. And so drummers my age, I think we all share the same appreciation for and fascination of all these different styles of music that just kind of were combined or were colliding.
Maybe present drummers hear drummers like you and take all of your influences on board. So the kind of world music influences that might come out of the funk, now you're their main influence.
You know, if somebody gets something from the way I play, and it's going to sound like false modesty or something, but
they do, but you probably,
You hope they get some information or pleasure out of it. If you can be a positive influence, that's a nice thing. My main concern is for the other musicians on the bandstand.
I think you can hear that.
Thank you.
I got some of my information from a long conversation with the drummer in my band called Nick France, mm-hmm. who you have met.
Yeah, he's a great drummer.
And he sat down and we were talking together. He'd been staying because he'd been doing some gigs with my band at the weekend. And one of the things he said to me is he talked about you're a disciplined drummer and thoughtful in your approach. And he said what was great, what he admired in your drumming, one of the aspects was the fact that sometimes you wouldn't play something. The fact that you almost resisted the urge. So it actually comes out as quite thoughtful drumming. And he cited a few examples where he said you could have done that, but you didn't do that. And, you know, it's that kind of maturity in your playing, I think. I'd call it maturity, maybe thoughtfulness.
Thanks. What it is, really, it's kind of a visual way of playing. It's a musical equivalent of using light and shadow. Utilizing space that way or discipline to not play the obvious, to me, it's just much more interesting. It creates a lot more musical tension. It focuses the ear of the listener in a different way. And to play the expected thing, number one, it clutters up the space too much. And number two, it's boring. There are any number of good reasons to not do that. And for drummers who are interested in pursuing this, well, what I tell my students, I say, just play what you'd like to hear. And I think we often don't listen in real time to what we're doing. It's just like a conversation. You're spending all your time thinking about what it is you want to say instead of really listening to what the person's saying to you. So if you're not really listening to the music and just worrying about what to play, of course you're going to play the same old every time. But if you're really listening, you'll, oh, yeah, I didn't have to play anything. You know, and you just become more involved with listening. And then you begin to hear the music like, the audience is hearing it. You begin to hear it in the studio as the microphones are hearing it. I did a recording a few years ago in Capitol Studios, and the drums were not in the separate drum booth or drum room, the isolation room, but I was in the same room with all the other instruments. And I played in a typical drums, okay, the band's getting more exciting here, so I'll do this. And then when I listened back, I was like, wow, that sounds really awful. And I realized that the drums were being heard not just by the drum microphones, but they were being heard by the trumpet microphones and the trombone microphones and the saxophone microphones, so that the drums gained a width to the sound that was unexpected and unwarranted. And immediately I went, this is why drummers played the way they played back then. This is why they made those choices. So I became quite sparing. And then it sounded good.
And then you were happy with what
and I was happy. The less I played, the better it sounded.
That's interesting, isn't it? So recording techniques affect how you play, essentially.
Which is the room. This is drummer talk, but one thing a lot of drummers do, myself included, when we play the snare drum and we want to play an accent, a louder note, we tend to play the drum not just on the head, but a combination of hitting the head and the metal hoop. And of course, when you get when you want a really loud rim shot, you do that. But we hit that part of the drum, those two parts of the drum, simultaneously a lot more than we realize. And what happens when you hit that is it just takes up a huge amount of bandwidth. And so you've heard it plenty. You know, when a drummer does that, it just kind of wipes out everything else for that second or so on stage, and it's just annoying, you know, and. I don't like music that repels the listener, that makes the listener kind of instinctively lean back. I want to draw them in so they instinctively lean forward. You know, that was sort of the ethos or the idea behind a lot of the ECM stuff we were doing. And then I at a certain point I felt, well, I'd taken it too far. My father didn't like those albums. He got not bored, but he just wanted to hear more drumming. And eventually I did too. But being armed with sort of the experience or the knowledge of or the awareness of sound, then it made the funk drumming more fun for me. So there's more power, but there's still, I think, a pretty good use of space. I hope. Thank you. That was Uncle Don, and I wrote that in memory and in tribute to the late Don Gronick. It quotes some of his harmonic language verbatim, but it was the only way I could capture the essence of Don, and it's a feel-good tune. The earlier tune that we listened to is something that I originally recorded with my ECM trio, that I called the ECF Trio, was the late John Taylor on piano and the Swedish bass player, Palle Danielsson. That's called For the Time Being. This is this version is a much more kind of Weather Report-ish realization of the tune. And I dedicated on the album to Ayrton Moreira,
yeah,
the great Brazilian drummer and percussionist, sort of doing a poor man percussion imitation or musical impersonation of some of the stuff he's done over the years. I sent him the CD and he listened to it. He said, "Yeah, I like it."
Well, that's nice. It's nice when you...
I'm glad he liked it, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. I'm going to go on to a question now that actually, again, it's kind of tying in nicely. Over your long and successful career as a drummer, you've played with bands such as Weather Report, Steps, Steely Dan, Joni Mitchell, and many UK musicians you were just talking about, such as Kenny Wheeler and John Taylor. We'll talk a little bit more about them in a minute, but what would you put as the highlights of your career?
Truthfully speaking, several highlights have occurred here in London. Getting to play the Queen Elizabeth Hall with Don Gronick, Michael Brecker, and Randy Brecker as part of Don's group. It was a thrilling concert. Steve Gadd was in the audience that night. He had just started rehearsing with Eric Clapton. And it was just so much fun. Getting to rehearse and then play Kenny Wheeler's music for large and small ensembles, including the suite that he wrote, was also, you know, a thrill. I mean, the impact that music has had on people. It was great just getting to work with Kenny and John Taylor and Dave Holland, and that whole big band was remarkable, and John Abercrombie was part of that. And then recording-wise, I think the Joni Mitchell album, Both Sides Now, might be one of the highlights of the stuff I've gotten to do. We recorded that at Air Studios here in London. Vince Mendoza wrote these incredible charts, and Joni was incredibly well prepared. Probably 85% of the vocals you hear on that album were tracked during those first takes. I mean, almost everything was a first take from Joni and the orchestra. We rehearsed it, and then boom, did it. I remember speaking with the security guard at the studio at one point, and he came up to me and said, "You know, I don't know what project you're all working on," he said, "but I've never seen the London musicians behave this way." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It just seems like something really special is going on. Everyone's kind of hovering in reverence." I remember during one of the playbacks, I looked out into the orchestra room. They were playing it back in on speakers for the other musicians to hear. And the violinists were all crying because the music was just so moving. And you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. And you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all. Say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. Oh, but now old friends, they're acting strange, and they shake their heads and they tell me that I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. It's life's illusions that I recall. I really don't know life. I really don't know life at all.
I was just going to talk a little bit about the English musicians, and I interviewed John Taylor a few years ago, as people know, unfortunately, his untimely death, 72, I think. I know, quite a sad thing, but I was a real fan of his music and his playing, met him on several occasions, absolutely loved his music. And I didn't know Kenny Wheeler, but obviously very familiar, and some of our greatest outputs. I mean, we've had quite a few from the UK, definitely those two. And I just wondered, you know, how did you get this connection with Kenny and John Taylor?
It was all thanks to a man named Nick Purnell.
I know Nick Purnell.
Do you know Nick?
Yeah, because, yeah, he's a friend of my brother's, or was, or something.
I would love to get word to him, because I haven't spoken to him in ages, but it's all thanks to Nick.
Wow.
I mean, Nick connected me with Kenny, he connected me with JT, he connected me with Mark Anthony Turnage. I mean, that's another highlight, you know, Turnage, when I met him and we did Blood on the Floor with John Scofield, but Mark wrote a concerto for drum set and orchestra. And I've played that, I've done it in Los Angeles, I've done it in Bonn, Germany, in Bochum, Germany.
You also played
in Helsinki, Europe. Finland, and in Tokyo. Nick Purnell was a guy that introduced me to all these people.
Wow.
And it was part of one of the arts councils with Tony Dudley Evans.
Yes, I know Tony. Yeah. I'm from Birmingham originally.
All right.
So they're all
based in Birmingham. And so from like the late 80s on, I found myself in this circle of people. The initial meeting with Kenny and John happened because we were sharing a bill. I was playing with John Abercrombie's trio, and Kenny and John and Norma Winston were playing as the group Azimuth, and we were sharing.
I loved that group as well.
Huh?
I love that group as well. That was one of my favorite.
Yeah, and normally, you know, so it was at some club. I think it was Fat Tuesdays in New York, and normally when the other band plays, you decide to like go out and get some fresh air, do something. We couldn't leave the room. I was just astonished by what I was hearing, and so I thought, wow, to get to play drums with someone with this kind of rhythmic sophistication and hyper awareness like John Taylor had would be a dream. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, I got to play as part of Kenny's quintet, and then eventually started making the trio albums with John Taylor.
I've got one that I really like. It's called As It Is. Is that an ECM one?
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some great tracks on there. I love the, is it Esperanza? Is that
the Vince Mendoza
composition. Yeah, and Touch Her Sweet Lips, that one by
William Walton.
Just beautiful music. In fact, I'd quite like to play Esperanza. So here we go. Let's have a listen to that. So yeah, we were talking about UK musicians and your association with the late Kenny Wheeler and John Taylor. But one of the great things about being a musician is your music does live on. So that's a wonderful thing. We just listened to a track called Esperanza.
If any of your listeners are fans of the Kenny Wheeler albums on ECM, The Widow in the Window, or or music for large and small ensembles, the CD that might really blow their minds. And I just received this as a gift from an American trumpeter named Brian Shaw, who's working on a biography of Kenny Wheeler. And he started talking to me about this album of Kenny's titled Windmill Tilter. It's about Don Quixote. And Kenny wrote this music for the Johnny Dankworth Orchestra. And this was this legendary album. I'd always heard about this record. And this was before it had become available on CD. And collectors would spend hundreds of pounds if they could find this album. And so I never thought I'd get a chance to get my hands on it and hear it. So Brian sent it to my home. My wife brought the package with the mail that had arrived since I began all this touring. I opened it up, and here I am in London. We're renting this little flat. It has a little stereo system with a CD player. So I said, oh my God, here it is, a Windmill Tilter. And it features a very young John McLaughlin, one of his first recordings. And it's just incredible. And all the seeds of the stuff I would know Kenny and his music for are contained in this recording from, I think it's 1966.
Wow.
Most of those same musicians were part of the big band that Kenny put together. Maybe it was 69, because I think it was, it was 20, 69, because in 89 we did the... And I remember thinking it was 20 years later. It's something how the dots connect, the circles seem to overlap. And somehow I found myself getting to play with so many wonderful British musicians. And I mean, I haven't gotten to play much with John McLaughlin. That's one gentleman I'd like to... I think he's retiring soon.
You've got to get in there so quickly. I mean, I think it's lovely collaboration. I love the idea of different, countries coming together. I mean, I suppose we feel quite connected to the States, and there's obviously that link. But I do think collaboration between, and working, it's nice to have that connection, isn't it, really, between places.
Different points of view,
Right.
Kenny Wheeler, he wrote the music playing flugelhorn. Derek Watkins... Henry Lowther, they were both in the ECM big band. Chris Pine, Mike Gibbs, of course, I've worked with a lot. Tony Coe, the wonderful saxophonist, is playing all over this. John McLaughlin, Dave Holland, who did the big band thing. It's just remarkable. So this was recorded in March of 1968. Just over 20 years later, we got to do the Kenny Wheeler big band. There's just so much heart in this music. Windmill Tilter, the story of Don Quixote. And we have Johnny Dankworth to thank.
What track should we have a listen to?
I think The Cave of Montesinos. It's track number 6, but they're all great. The name of the album is Windmill Tilter. It's the story of Don Quixote told by Ken Wheeler, who we know as Kenny Wheeler, and the John Dankworth Orchestra, featuring a very young John McLaughlin, Dave Holland.
We were talking a bit about your playing with English musicians, UK musicians, and then you mentioned about playing some music by composer Mark Anthony Turnage, and you played in the opera Anna Nicole. Uh-huh. And I came to see it because
some of
my friends are in it. Yeah, John Paricelli and Mark Lockhart were playing with you. And I've got to say, it was one of the best operas I saw. I know it's probably disrespectful for the tradition, but for me it was everything you get in an opera. It was dramatic, it was funny, you know. I'm going to say this. There are scenes where it's the story of someone from a very low background with nothing much, and how she builds her life. She ends up having breast enlargements. And the funny thing, of course, in the opera is they're all talking about you should have a D, no, a double D. Why not a double G? You know, and it's the comedy of the opera. And then obviously there's the tragedy after she marries someone like in his 80s, is it John someone Marshall the Third or something, and it seems that she's married him for money, and there's all this tragedy, and then her son dies, and then she dies, and I watched the whole thing and I was holding back the tears at the end. It was so moving. And of course, having the jazz element, although it isn't really a jazz opera, but it has elements of jazz, and I just loved it. And then I watched it again on television, you know, which I never would do that normally, and it still affected me, you know.
Well, the libretto is scatological in places, but brilliantly clever. The music, though, is stunningly good. And if you feel like having a good cry at the end of an opera, it's because the music just...
Did you feel emotional?
Oh yeah, yeah, very. People characterize Mark Anthony Turner's music as, you know, it's iconoclastic, it's discordant possibly or whatever, but I think of him as a very romantic composer. He's very tuneful, and when you start investigating the layers, because there's so many layers going on musically with him, there's just a tremendous amount of melody and heart in the music. I find him to be a very melodic and emotional composer, in addition to his being all the other things that make him exciting. And
I really like his stuff. What I've heard, it's like I said in that opera, I was moved. I love the music, but also how it related to the story was great.
Of course, my favorite opera right now is La Boheme. I've at this late stage of my life just discovered La Boheme, and I'm like, wow, this is really a great opera. And it's kind of like you said, you know, it has everything you want in your opera. It's got the drama, it's got the spectacle, it's got the pathos, it's got the humor, love rising, love found, love lost, and melodies. You know, you got to have tuneful melodies. And Anna Nicole had some really great melodies. The thrill in getting to do that, of course, anytime I get to play with John Parricelli, also Martin Robertson, the saxophonist who was in the orchestra, was getting to play with John Paul Jones, played bass and also one of the mandolin part. For those listeners who might not understand the significance of John Paul Jones, he was the original bass player in Led Zeppelin. I was, you know, I never paid that much attention to Led Zeppelin because I was kind of a jazz snob at the time. My loss. But I knew that John Paul Jones had been a studio musician of some note and experience in London before he joined this band of kind of superstars. Anyway, while most of the music in Anna Nicole was written, you know, it was fairly tightly controlled playing space for us, we were waiting to rehearse one of the big dance scene, the big party scene. And so I was there with a stand-up, we called a cocktail kit.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And John Paul Jones had this small bass amp. And we just started jamming. And I got to experience this amazing, big, wide, fat beat that English bass players have. And it's different from any other bass player's beat. And I don't know how else to describe it, but I was just like, wow, I'm actually getting to play this beat with John Paul Jones. And as much fun as the opera was, that was the highlight of the experience. It's like 30 seconds of just, holy cow. Getting the jam with John Paul Jones.
He's
a lovely guy, incredibly modest. We came back after a weekend. Hey, John, how was your weekend? Oh, it was good. I said, what'd you do? Oh, not much. Won a Grammy. He's won a Grammy. I thought, oh, congratulations. We'll be right back.
kind of really getting into what music we like, and it's always nice when conversations go about that. And I have to say this, because we have favourite albums through our lives, things that we remember very strongly. And one of my favourite albums is Motion Poet, which I listen to over and over and over again. I actually write music, and I found it quite influential. I'm actually going to play one of the tracks from that album in a minute, Hero with a Thousand Faces, which I love that one. That has a solo with John Abercrombie, and then it's Michael Brecker just playing it out. Every time I hear it, it's just like, wow.
Well, you know what you might like? You should go to my website. There's a section on the website where I have digital music, and I have an alternate take. It was Michael's first solo.
I'm going to check it out.
The one on the album was his second pass. We were recording on 24 tracks of digital tape. Michael had recorded on the final remaining track. I thought it was great, but we were all pretty confident, you know, he could play an even better one, and he wanted to, but I didn't want to erase what he had done. So we, I think it was either the click track it must have been the click track. We used a click track and erased that so he could have a track to play on, because we maxed out the number of tracks. It's not like today with computers and Pro Tools. Anyway, I had that original reel-to-reel digital tape, and there's a gentleman who works at Warner Brothers Records in Burbank, California, and he transferred this stuff, and it was all still there. So I had remembered Michael, the first time he ran it down, played a pretty great solo. So I've remixed it and released the track with that, and also a couple of alternate takes of some of the other tunes. So
great.
But this particular solo, it's one of my favorite Michael Brecker solos. I'm glad you chose this. Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Let's listen.
Thank you.
So that was Hero with a Thousand Faces, and that was off an album called Motion Poet, and it's Peter Erskine's album.
And we should mention it's a Vince Mendoza arrangement and composition.
And I recommend checking out that album, because it's a classic. It's got some really great tunes on there. So I'm coming towards the end of my interview with Peter Erskine. I have to say that I could probably sit here for a long time, but I promised not to make it too long.
Well, with the length of my answers, we could be here for a long time.
I know. Sorry. So I'm just going to finish with a couple of things. One of them is you're at Ronnie Scott's next week, and this is with the pianist Kenny Werner. And it's described as Art of the Quartet. And I just wondered, I was going to say, is it your current band? But you obviously have many, many bands. So.
It's a bit of a cheeky name for a band. It's not my band. The leader really is Benjamin Koppel, the Danish saxophonist who brought Kenny and myself together with the bassist Johannes Weidenmuller. A few years ago, we played at the Montmartre Club, Copenhagen. We then played the Jazz Festival in Copenhagen last summer with Scott Colley on bass. And we all had such a good time, we thought, well, we should, you know, play more gigs than what might be available in Copenhagen. So we're beginning the tour at Ronnie's on Monday and Tuesday. That's the 28th and 29th of May. And then we'll be taking the train to Paris and doing a couple nights there, and a couple nights in Germany, and then several nights up in Denmark. I'm looking forward to it. This trip has been an interesting one for me, because I started off with the Dr. Band. Benjamin Shepherd couldn't make the tour because he and his wife just had a baby.
Oh, great.
So congratulations to Tara and Benjamin. And anyway, my nephew Damian Erskine, who's a great electric bass player, he came out and played. And then I did a career retrospective at the WDR radio in Cologne, Germany, and Vince Mendoza conducted and arranged most all of that music. And so the first thing was electric, and then big band, and now this is acoustic. So I'll get to dive into that lighter, more acoustically transparent world of playing for the next couple of weeks. Looking forward to it.
And that's the next couple of weeks. And in terms of maybe things to expect in the future, is there something?
I'm hoping to get to play the Turner's Concerto a few more times. No, you know, I'm not sure. My wife and I have enjoyed this 20-some year experiment, having the record label, but it's a lot of work, and we might let the catalog sit and mature for a bit without creating too much more new product. I turned 64 in a week or so. Looking to shed things. I'm my whole vinyl record collection I'm selling to a Japanese record store. A lot of great titles. I've been working on that database of all that stuff, and I think I want to stay home more, and I'd like to try writing some more music, maybe also write another, maybe a follow-up to my autobiography.
I haven't read that.
You haven't read that?
No, but my very, very good friend Nick France has, which is why he gave me loads of information about you, although obviously I knew quite a lot beforehand, but I'm definitely going to read it now.
I think it's a fun read. It's called No Beethoven. The title came from something that Joe Zawinul said to me when we were in Weather Report. He was bragging about his composing prowess, and he said, "I ain't afraid of no Beethoven." And that sort of captured the whole machismo kind of ethos of that band, which informed so much of not only, you know, the opportunities I would have, but how I would make music for quite some time. And so there's still a few untold stories that I might want to set down. So I think the next couple of years may involve less traveling, a little more reflection and contemplation and teaching. I teach online at a place called artistworks.com, and I also teach at the University of Southern California. That's a big part of jazz, you know, paying it forward, passing along the knowledge. You know how that goes, so. That'll be a good place to put my energy for a bit.
Well, thank you so much for giving up quite a lot of your time in this brief visit to the UK. And I wish you all the best in your future gigs. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And thank I look you. Forward. I hope we get a chance to play together sometime.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I'm afraid that's all I've got time for today. So many thanks to Peter Erskine for his wonderful music and giving up time to be interviewed. I'm going to finish with a track. This is from an album called John Abercrombie, Mark Johnson, Peter Erskine. And they're obviously on the album. And this is a track called Samurai Hee-Haw. This is Andrea Vicari, Jazz Doodles, jazzlondonradio.com.